Taking a second cup of coffee to the bathroom, I showered. It wasn't a long, luxurious shower, not with the size of the hot water tank, but it was at least hot. I checked the calendar to make sure it wasn't a church day, as I had promised Mama I'd come to services on Sunday, and dressed in work clothes. Still caffeinating my body, I repacked my go-bag, put a load of clothes on to wash, and drank a third and then a fourth cup of coffee, while I rubbed down a few venison loins with oil and my own spicy recipe meat rub, before I put them in a Dutch oven on the hottest part of the stovetop. Awake enough to slice veggies without carving off a finger, I added veggies and diced potatoes. Satisfied that I'd have food to eat in a warm house when I got home, I finished a few housekeeping chores, made more coffee, and poured it into a 30-ounce travel mug, put the cats on the back porch for the night, and locked the door. I was halfway to Siled when my cell jangled and JoJo's voice said, "Justin Tolliver's house is burning. Sending address to your cell. Lights and siren. LaFleur wants you there ASAP." I pulled off the road, slapped the lights in place, turned on the siren, and set the cell to give me directions to Tolliver's house. I drank coffee all the way there, knowing for sure that caffeine was a gateway drug to crack. Had to be. Mama would be horrified if I ever let that slip. The sun was setting over the bend of the Tennessee River when I pulled up to the mansion, parked, and slid to the ground. The rear of the place was engulfed, flames flinging themselves out of the windows and doors, and the holes in the roof created by the firefighters. The roar and crackle of the fire, the rushing of water through the fire hose, the thrum of diesel generators, all created a rush of heat and noise unlike any other. I had never seen such a huge inferno and found myself struck still and speechless as the fire's heat and might reached out and gripped me in its raging fingers, scorching my face even out in the street. Glowing embers and stinking ash fell from the sky, burning. I tossed my good coat back in the truck and pulled a hand-me-down on instead. The heavy coat had belonged to John, my husband, and it hung on my too slender form. But it was something I didn't mind getting burned, and it had a hood, which I raised over my hair as I watched the scene. I reseated my weapon in the holster, made sure my badge was in view before I locked up the C-10. Three fire trucks were on site, pulled up in the grass, two pumping water in through the roof holes, one watering down trees nearby to keep the fire from spreading. Firefighters strode through the ruined lawn, each wearing heavy gear and oxygen tanks and fire-blackened yellow coats. Feds were on site, too, as was P. Simon, the former Green Beret alt-security guy from the Holloway's party, and Rick, his silver-laced black hair sparkling. A group had gathered beneath the protection of the wide arms of a fir tree. I looked around and saw a small sign that read, "Alt-Security." It was interesting that a man with so many personal problems was at the side of another situation involving the Tollivers. I sent that info to headquarters and heard back instantly that Alt was the highest-rated private security firm in eastern Tennessee. All the rich and famous use them for protection and security. Before I left the truck, I sent back a two-word text. "Still strange." I jogged over to them. There were three uniformed men from KFD and two feds, both from previous crime scenes, Chadworth Sanders Hamilton and E.M. Schultz. There was also a small group of four civilians, Justin and Sonia Tolliver, and their two children. The smallest child wore what looked like pajamas with bunny slippers and a blanket wrapped around him. The massive fir tree was dripping wet from a drenching by the fire hose, but offered protection from the falling ash. I was joining a debriefing in the middle. One of the fire department uniforms was saying, "Preliminary testing indicates that an accelerant was present near the back of the house, probably gasoline." I turned my eyes to him, blinking against the dark, my retinas burned by the flame, my mouth firmly shut. These were the bigwigs of this investigation, and I didn't want to get myself thrown off the scene. He continued, "It's too early to definitively call it, but I suspect arson." "I think that assessment is premature," Justin said, his voice clipped and precise, sounding like a lawyer, even in his shirt sleeves and damp pants and house shoes. He scrubbed his head with both hands, leaving his hair standing up in tufts, staring at the house with eyes that looked too large, too full of emotions that I couldn't decipher. The lawn care company kept supplies under the back deck. I never saw a gasoline can, but it's possible they left one there. Sir, the fire investigator started. No. His hands slid down his face, past his nose, which was hooked like Abrams's, nostrils too narrow for his face, a Tolliver feature. Not until you have something more conclusive than just a hit on gasoline. Sonia leaned against Justin, crying softly. He didn't lift his arm to wrap around her. Instead, he dropped his hands from his face and gripped his wife's shoulders, setting her aside as if she was in the way. There was trouble in this marriage, I thought, and I wondered how much the house had been insured for, and if one of them had seen a divorce lawyer recently, and then wondered how I had changed so quickly from churchwoman thoughts to law enforcement thoughts. I'd never have considered such a thing only a few months past. Justin said, it could have been electrical, maybe a short in and outside outlet, and if there was gas under the porch, then the can got hot from the fire. It probably burned and splashed flaming liquid up the walls, right? Even I knew Justin was being foolish. He had been present at two shootings and now his house was on fire. He had sensed that he was, perhaps, a target. Gasoline doesn't act like that, sir. One of the fire department's uniformed men said gently, special effects on TV and movies are often wrong. Special Agent Hamilton smirked at Tolliver. So far, my distant cousin had shown no particularly good character traits. I had a feeling that I was not going to like him, even if I ever got to know him better. I looked back at the burning structure just in time to see a partial roof on the back of the house, maybe a porch roof, fall in. The crash shook the ground, jarring up my legs and spine. The embers shot high, the flames finally freed to feed on the air, ravenous, destructive. I knew how that fire felt. If I ever let my bloodlust go, it would feel that way. Explosive, ferocious, violent. Sonia walked away from her husband, closer to the fire, as if mesmerized. Justin followed, the flames reflected off his skin, glowing golden. Schultz turned, her gaze following the Tolliver's actions, her face to the fire, her dark skin gleaming. This house burning like a torch might be a crime of opportunity, a fluke of timing. Softer so it didn't carry, she asked, are the Tollivers getting along? No one replied. Rick said, Ingram. Thoughts about this fire? I flinched, just the tiniest bit, then raised my hands to lower my hood, taking the time to evaluate Rick's question and think how I wanted to say this. Since Justin Tolliver was at the scenes of both shootings, coincidence, while possible, seems unlikely. Even though there's a different M.O. here, there's a good chance it's tied to the Holloway crime scene. And the restaurant, even if only by copycat or opportunity. How high? Rick asked. I'm not a mathematician, I said, keeping my words toneless. This is just common sense, using reason and probability. I hoped that was what Rick had wanted to hear. However, if I was right, and killing Justin or Sonia was the objective all along, that meant that Ming, the witches, and Senator Abrams Tolliver could be cut from the possible list of targets. And with no absolute proof that the assailant was a known paranormal creature, the Secret Service and Psi-Led both would probably pack up and go home. Until we had a witness, a clear video, or a tissue sample that could be analyzed, there was no paranormal. What can you tell me? Rick asked me. It was a hint to go read the land. I pulled my flash from my pocket and nodded to the group. I'll check the grounds with the psi-meter. Mr. Tolliver, I called out, your wife needs a hug. I spun on the grass and left the group before Rick could tell me to mind my own business. The Tollivers, Justin and Sonia and their children, had a good 3 acres, which was a large patch of ground this close to inner city Knoxville and Sequoia Hills. I stayed out of the way of the fire crews and under the dripping forest of trees and shrubs on the boundaries of the property. There was a shed in back, with an old flatwater kayak leaning against the wall. It looked recently used, clean, and not covered with yard dust, as it might if it had sat for a while. Beside it, there were a pair of wading boots, a tackle box, and what looked like a fishing rod, broken down into easy-to-carry segments. At the back of the shed, the psi-meter 2.0 showed the telltale spikes at level 4, spikes that led toward the house. I caught Rick's eye and held up 4 fingers. I knew he'd see them in the dark. Cat eyes. He gave me a minuscule nod. I put the expensive device away and got my blanket. It was faded, frayed, an ugly pink thing. But I liked it. It made me feel good about reading the land, as if I brought part of Soulwood with me each time I sat on it. I stopped several times to try to read the ground, but the fire had woken the plants. Usually when I read flora, I got nothing, because plants were sluggish thinkers, slow to reorganize anything of humankind other than the fire that came in our wake and the destruction of chainsaws. But this was the ancient enemy of life. Fire was the destroyer. All I got from the plants I touched was fear, fire, fear, fire. From everything, from the grass, shrubs, the old firs and oaks. The warnings had spread from plant to plant. At the back of the property, behind the shed where I had first found the level 4 sassatope spikes, I finally found something other than fear sizzling through the flora. I found several spots of death when I placed the blanket down and sat, hidden by shadows and winter bare flora, put my hands into the earth, digging my fingernails down for a light read. The plants in a narrow opening between 2 maples were beginning to die, exactly the way the plants had died at the other house. Standing again, I traced the passage of death. Sliding into the dark undergrowth between the trees, I switched off the flash, tucking my coat under me. I sat in the shadows and placed my hands flat on the ground, digging my fingertips into the soil beneath. The roots were dead. Here was the spot the assassin had come in by. I got up and brushed my hands off. Using the flash, I followed the trail back through the woods, along a rivulet creek that fed the Tennessee River, to a tertiary road where I lost the trail of dead plants. Tracking my way back, I fingered the plants, tearing off leaves and small stems and digging out rootlets. They looked and felt dead, but also smelled, very faintly, burned. Had I missed the scent at the Holloways? It had been much colder that night. I had been exhausted, hungry. It was possible I missed something. Back at the house, standing in the overhang of trees, I studied the yard, where I'd felt a second patch of dead. It was near the garage, where the Tollivers seemed to park their cars. I needed to go back to the Holloways and smell the plants at the first crime scene. Rick caught my eye across the lawn and I nodded slowly, hoping he understood what I was saying, that it was the same attacker. He nodded back curtly and gestured me over. I made my way along the edge of the property back to the small group. "So," I asked, "gas?" "Yes and no," said a man in a fire department uniform and a winter coat. "Gasoline was recovered from the gas can under the porch, but the can was below the worst of the heat and didn't explode. Didn't contribute to the fire at all. From the way the fire started, on both stories at the same time, and the way it spread, inward from both levels and fast, I'd say the structure was targeted with a flamethrower. But we didn't get a hit on known accelerants except the gasoline. If the sprinkler system hadn't come on, some of the family, particularly the kids, might not have gotten out alive. The fire ate right through their rooms." Sonia Tollifer sobbed, gathered her children close, and herded them toward a big SUV. She opened the door with the keypad and climbed in with the children, shutting the door on the fire and the unwelcome information. Her husband looked us over and then fled after his family. When the vehicle door closed, Rick asked me, "Ingram, what did you determine?" "It's the same attacker," I said, "or the same species as the previous attacker. A paranormal." "You can't know that," Schultz said. "In a couple of days, the plants in a specific trail are going to start to die. If you want, I can mark it off for you once the fire department is finished. At the Holloway's house, I detected the same kind of trail. There should be dead plants along it now. Go look."
"And how do we know you didn't create this trail?"
Hamilton asked, his eyes hard, piercing me through the smoke-filled air that swirled our way. This man, like other law enforcement officials, knew that Unit 18 was composed of mostly paranormals, although he probably didn't know what I was. It was a good guess that I wasn't human. My cuz didn't like paranormals, which just ticked me off something terrible. I narrowed my eyes at him and drew on my churchwoman accent. I had learned that deliberately using it seemed to throw people off their game, as if they didn't quite know how to relate to me. Oddly enough, it had become part of my arsenal. "Are you asking me if I am the unknown suspect who shot the people at the Holloway's fundraiser party?" I asked, squaring my shoulders and advancing on him. "Are you asking me if I have a flamethrower? Are you just trying to cause trouble? Or are you trying to make me specifically mad? I'm just curious, since Ewan's being an ass and all." Rick coughed, but I had a feeling the choked sound was laughter stuck in his throat. It also let me know that Hamilton was being difficult to all the paranormals, and not just me. Schultz said, "Hamilton, do you have a problem with Special Agent Ingram? If not, back off, Proby." Hamilton shoved his fists into his suit coat pockets and took a step back, but he was staring back and forth at Rick and me. Hamilton was looking more and more like a paranormal hater and had decided to dump me in with the wares and witches on Psy-Led Unit 18. Or maybe he was another one who hated me for exposing his former boss as a shapeshifter and cannibal when they'd had no idea. That seemed to have left a bad taste in a lot of FBI agents' mouths. Schultz went on as if nothing rude had been said on either side. "So either Justin Tolliver was the primary target all along, or the entire family is under attack."
"Politics or money?" Rick asked.
"Both." She looked at the house. "First I'll get Hamilton to pull records, financials, political contributions, life insurance, marital problems." She glanced at the SUV where the Tollivers had taken refuge. "Follow the money."
"I agree," Rick said. "This means we'll have to guard the senator and his entire family at work, home, governmental buildings, travel, and school."
Schultz made a rude sound and said, "I'll call it in. We need more people until we stop this guy." She studied Rick.
"Can you, you know, smell anything?"
"You mean like smoke?"
Rick asked, an amused glint in his eyes. "Something humans can't pick up." E.M. Schultz shrugged, her gaze taking in the lean ware leopard.
"House is damaged, too hot to work up right now. But U-18's investigatory technique goes about things a bit differently, I've heard."
"Sometimes," Rick acknowledged. "And underneath the stench of burning wood, brick, synthetic fibers, wallboard, shingle, stone, and a dozen other household stinks, I do smell something odd. Not magical, not where, not anything I can put my finger on. But if it comes to me, I'll call."
Schultz tilted two fingers into a chest pocket and removed a card. "Business and personal numbers. Anytime." I watched Rick take the card, his eyes alight. But when Schultz glanced back at the house, the flirty glow in his gaze faded fast, into something bitter and grieving. Wares can't have sexual relations with humans without passing along to them the wear taint, which was an automatic death sentence carried out by Grindelows, the cute but deadly judge, jury, and executioner of the Ware community. Not that many humans knew all that, likely Schultz included, which meant that if I was interpreting the little scene correctly, Schultz wanted to date Rick and he couldn't date her but wanted to, and maybe flirted by instinct. Even outside of a polygamous church, romantic and physical relationships weren't easy. I scowled, my mind envisioning Oakham, the way he had looked last time I saw him. Blonde hair floating, scruffy beard, and for some reason that image hurt me on a level that made no sense, except that Oakham couldn't have anyone either, unless he and Rick wanted to get together, and I didn't see either of them want the other. Unless my body and mind stilled. I wasn't human. That meant that Oakham and I could...
Nell?
I flinched, looked up into Rick's black eyes, and realized he had been talking to me for a while. The other agents were gone, and it was just Rick and me under the trees. Yeah?
The feds will be providing protection for the senator and his family, and Justin and his family. And they have requested a paranormal LEO on site. That means that our unit will be doing double duty, tracking the assassin and providing body detail.
I tilted out my thumb in a gesture that meant, please continue.
The senator's house is a huge chunk of real estate with a 6,000-square-foot main house, a guest house, three pools, and tennis courts in Sequoia Hills on Cherokee Boulevard. It backs up to the Tennessee River and is well protected from all sides. The feds intend to move all the extended family onto the property.
I tapped my cell and checked the time. It was a little after 4 a.m. The night had flown by as I read and communed with the grounds. You want me there?
You can go home. I want you to sleep today if you can and take the night shift tonight, 9 to 9 a.m.
Good. I'd like to sleep me some sleep.
Go. I'll send Senator Tolliver's address to your cell. Be on time.
Copy, I said, and made my way to my truck. I could barely keep my eyes open on the drive back home, but I didn't make it home before my cell rang and I knew instantly that my morning nap was about to be tampered with. Good morning, Mama, I said tiredly. Nellie, girl, I'd be most appreciative if and you and would drop by for a bit, breakfast in half an hour. Mama, we uns having French toast and waffles and eggs and bacon. Thank you and pumpkin, see you in a bit. The connection ended. I didn't know what Mama wanted or what she had up her sleeve, but I knew it was likely something sneaky, probably several something sneaky. Manipulation was an art form among the women in the church. Knowing I should go straight home to my bed, I put on the blinker and turned toward the church lands. Chapter 5. My ID was sufficient to get me onto the compound of God's Cloud of Glory Church, and I turned off the C-10's lights as the truck crawled forward. Holding my flash out the driver's window, I searched into the shadows on either side of the road, looking for fresh shoots of the vampire tree. It was too dark to make out anything in the gloom of a cloudy dawn. In the darkness beneath the scrub pressing up against the 12-foot-tall fence that surrounded the church grounds. Dissatisfied with my perusal, but unwilling to abandon the heated air and search on foot, I rolled the window back up, put the lights back on, and took the most direct route to the Nicholson house. The fact that the most direct route bypassed the vampire tree was just happenstance. Mostly. It was still there. Still creepy. I parked the old Chevy beneath the trees in front of the three-story structure that was home to my extended family. My father, my mama, her two sister wives, and all the assorted sibs and half-sibs. Before I could get out of the truck, the door was yanked open and Mud, or Mindy as the rest of the family called her, threw herself inside and hugged me so hard I thought I might break in too. I missed you. She mumbled into my coat. Before I could respond, she reared back and said, "You and stink like fire. Not like a campfire, but like garbage burning. I dropped off the seat to the ground and said, I was at a house fire, part of my job. She narrowed her eyes and studied me like she might an unfamiliar beetle she found eating basil in the greenhouse. Did somebody try to burn a family out? Was they witches? Her voice dropped. Did they burn her at the stake? No one got burned. No stake. All house fires stink really bad. And in the real human world, witches don't get burned at the stake. Mud made a sound of disagreement that was remarkably like Mama's and took my hand, pulling me up the steps to the porch. Breakfast is on. You ain't coming to church with us this morning? No, just breakfast and then home. You ain't falling away. The Mamas say you ain't falling away and drifting into sin. I have a job, and no, I'm not falling into sin, but I don't worship at God's cloud anymore. You ain't going to church anywheres else? Because if you ain't going to church, then you ain't falling into sin. Sam said so. Did he now? Sam was my older full sib and a bit of a worry wart. He also didn't always know when to keep his big mouth shut. I'll speak to Sam. Let him know I'm not falling into evil and damnation. Except I'd killed two men. So maybe I was. Mud shoved open the door to the house and dragged me inside. The roar of voices hit me in the face like a huge, fluffy pillow, warm and soft and smothering. I hung my winter coat on the wall tree, smelling bacon and waffles and French toast and coffee, as I followed Mud into the kitchen, where she pushed me onto a bench and brought me a cup of steaming tea. Mama, Nell worked all night putting out a fire, and she needs to sleep so don't nobody be giving her no coffee. It'll keep her awake. Instantly, I was bombarded with questions from the youngins about fires and the exciting life of a firefighter and when did they start letting some puny woman fight fires. And then I had to explain about not being a firefighter, but that women could do any job a man could except produce sperm to father children. At that point, I was called down by Mama Grace, Daddy's third and youngest wife, who said, Nell Nicholson Ingram. I know you and ain't been gone so long as to have forgotten what conversation is and is not appropriate for the breakfast table. Hush Ewan's mouth. Mama was coming in the front door and heard the final part of the conversation. Let the girl talk, she said. That's biology. And biology is schooling. Thanks, Mama, I said. Though at this age, she added as she fell onto the bench beside me, I'm of a mind to say something more. Coffee, please, Cora, she said, interrupting herself. Staring around the table at the females present, she continued. While men folk are handy to have around to do the heavy lifting, any smart woman can figure out how to do things on her own if necessary, and Nell has a point about the role of father and children. I sat still and listened as the young teenagers at the table dove into an argument about women's rights and women's role in the family, politics, business, and the world in general. The boys started demonstrating muscles, and their sisters told them to act like adults. And then suddenly, Ma-Ma was quoting Archimedes about using a lever to move the world, which digressed to Archimedes running around naked in public when he discovered new mathematic principles. And then the youngins in the main room started singing the alphabet song, followed by a song about Moses in the Nile, followed by a song about numbers that I had never heard before. I didn't even bother asking Mama about her great-nephew Hamilton, the FBI jerk. I let it all wash through me, absorbing it, and remembering all the good things that came from growing up in God's cloud. As awful as some parts had been growing up in Nicholson, had not all been bad. Mama plunked a plate in front of me stacked with French toast and a half dozen strips of maple-cured bacon. Melted butter ran down the yeasty, egg-soaked and drenched French-style bread, mixing with blueberry honey. My mouth watered and my throat made some sound of amazement, and Mama said, Eat. We'll bless it when your daddy gets here.
Then she upended a cup of her homemade whipped cream on top of the fried toast, and I dug in. Oh, yeah. Being a Nicholson was some kind of wonderful when it came to eating. I was mostly done, groaning with the pain of a too-full stomach, yet still scraping my spoon across the plate to get the final dregs of deliciousness off it, when there was the slightest hint of change in the ambient noise. In a flash, the teens scattered, some outside to chores, others up the stairs. Mama Grace, soft and rounded, as if her body had been lined with down fill, set a pot of stinky herbal tea at the head of the table and herded all the littlest youngins up the stairs, too. My own mama, Mama Cora, dished up a plate of waffles and set them beside the herbal tea. She removed my plate and poured me more China black tea. Her lips were tight. Her face was pinched. Something was up. And then I heard the faint thunking. Without even turning around, I knew why I had been asked to breakfast. I knew why everyone had gone running. They had set me up. I glared over the rim of my cup at Mama, and she ducked her head, not meeting my eyes. I swiveled on the bench and watched Mama Carmel, Daddy's senior wife, help Daddy from their room behind the kitchen to the table. Daddy looked pale enough to win a contest with a corpse, and sort of yellowed, too, what the church midwives called jaundice in babies. He had lost at least another 10 pounds, leaving his face saggy and his work clothes hanging on his frame. His hands carried a faint tremor. Daddy still had not been to the surgeon who put him back together after he was shot. When the group of shape-shifting devil dog Guishi tried to take over the church. Whatever was wrong inside him was getting worse. "Morning, Nelly," he said, easing into his chair with a pained sigh. "God's grace and peace to you today." My eyes flicked back and forth between the mamas again in accusation, and then I glared at my father. "I'd say the same thing back to Ewan, but Ewan don't deserve it." My father reared back in his chair.
"What did you say, young lady?"
"I said Ewan don't deserve God's grace and peace, since Ewan clearly been throwing it back into the face of the Almighty for weeks and weeks." Daddy opened his mouth and I stood up from the table so I could use height for intimidation. Tactics from Interrogation 101 at Spook School. Stuff I'd never expected to have to use on my own father. "You used to tell us to make use of all God's gifts and not ignore them. Not ever. That ignoring gifts was a sin. And yet God sent you to a surgeon after you got shot and gave you the gift of life so as you could continue to love and be loved and do God's will. That was a gift, and yet you in throwing that gift back in his face. I'm rightly ashamed of you, Daddy." Daddy opened his mouth and then closed it. Things were happening deep in his yellowed eyes too fast to follow. His mouth opened and then closed tight, opened again. He looked like a beached carp. Not that I was going to say that. I'd pushed as much as I was likely to get away with. After way too long, Daddy tilted his head to me and looked me over. Me in my work pants and dark suit jacket, bulge of my weapon in the small space between shoulder, armpit, and breast. He looked over at his wives, not a one of them looking at him. He made a disgusted sound deep in his throat.
"So that's the way of it now. My women folk ganging up on me?"
I thought about telling him I was no one's women folk. But Daddy needed to see his surgeon, and maybe that was more important than me standing up for himself. At least right now.
"Coffee, Cora, if you please," he said.
He pushed away the cup of herbal tea and accepted the cup of coffee, taking his gaze back to me, his interest particularly heavy. He sipped, still staring as he set the cup down on the table with a soft tap.
"Carmel, if you would be so kind, make an appointment with that doctor."
I didn't dare look away from him at the faces of the mamas, but I could practically feel the elation in the air.
If church women danced, they'd be do-si-doing right about now.
You, Nellie girl, Daddy said, will never speak to me in that tone again.
I raised my chin, knowing it was challenging, but I was a churchwoman no more, not a woman to be cowed by a man, even my father. I had gotten what I wanted. Now to nail it all down.
You and act you got some sense in your head, and I won't have to.
One of the mamas choked and started coughing. Daddy glared at me, his lower face hidden by his mug, his sickly eyes glaring.
I reckon we won't be talking about your future after all this.
What about my future? I demanded. I got me a good farm, good land, a good job, and good friends. I got family here and a life out in the world. And that's the way I like it.
But you're an alone, Nellie girl, and the mama's got a young man they want you to meet.
I blinked slowly and turned my gaze to my mama. I had been set up all right. I had been set up in two different ways at the same time, to harangue Daddy into seeing a doctor and try to get me back into the church.
You like him, Nell? Mama said, taking a step back at whatever she saw on my face.
She put a hand to her reddish-brown bun in a gesture that looked nervous and firmed her lips. Mama was a stubborn woman when she pushed through.
His name is Benjamin Aiden, and he's Sam's age. You've been gone a long time, but you and might remember him as a little'un. He's one of Brother Aiden's boys, college-educated now with a degree in renewable farming practices or some such. He's a modern kind of boy, and he only wants one wife. And he's coming for coffee.
At that moment, a knock sounded on the door, and Daddy grinned as he lifted a big fork full of waffles to his mouth. He looked a lot better than he had only moments past. Amusement at my discomfort seemed to agree with him. Getting back at me for my insolence probably made him even happier. Mud threw open the door and cold air raced past, stealing the heat of the house.
Mama, it's Benjamin and Sam.
I stepped away from the table as the two entered. Sam, sturdy and self-contained, peeling out of his jacket. And Benjamin, who pulled off a toboggan to reveal dark hair over deep blue eyes, a full mouth, and a strong jaw. He was pretty, taller than me, wearing traditional church-style clothes, but store-bought. Plaid shirt over t-shirt, newish jeans that had been ironed to a sharp crease. He had smooth skin and a look about him that said he'd be capable and quiet and kind. They came across the room, and I realized I was still standing, shoulders hunched, wearing smoke-stinky work clothes, pants, jacket, my service weapon under my jacket, my hair in a short bob, not bunned up like a proper woman, tired, no makeup or lipstick left on my mouth, and not sure if that was a good thing or a bad one. I was horrified at the thoughts I was having, as if any of that mattered. It didn't. I was the woman I wanted to be, yet my eyes darted around as if looking for a way out that wouldn't require me to address Benjamin. Daddy called the men to come on over, and then called for coffee, sounding hale and hearty, as if he wasn't actively dying from the damage inside him. Asking the women folk to serve the men folk, just the way it always used to be, just the way it always would be in the church. That realization somehow settled me, and my shoulders went back to their proper position instead of up around my ears.
Set a spell now,
Mama said, replacing my cup with a fresh one and pouring a pale tea. This one smelled of chamomile, ginger, and vanilla. I brought my gaze back from the men who were settling around the table, being served. Served by the women.
Don't you dare be rude, Mama hissed at me. He's a nice boy. You be nice to him.
I started to tell Mama off. I wanted to storm away. But Mama looked at me with pleading in her eyes, and I could do neither one. I blew out a breath. T-Lane would call this effed up family dynamics, the effed word in place of the regular one because they knew I didn't care for it much. And she would be right. Worse, it wasn't Benjamin's fault that Mama had set this up. Benjamin was the eldest son of Brother Aiden. I liked Brother Aiden, and I adored his second wife, Sister Erasmus. I could be polite. But that didn't mean I had to just sit and take this. "It's mighty warm in here," I said, as I pulled off my work jacket and draped it across a nearby chair back. I turned back around. My gun and its weapon harness in plain view, along with my badge clipped to my belt. The house went dead silent. I leaned across the table and held out my right hand. "Hi, Benjamin. I'm Nell. Good to meet you." Only a beat or two too late, Benjamin took my hand and shook it. I released his hand, which was warm and strong and tough-skinned. I lifted my long legs back across the bench one at a time, the way men did, instead of the way a woman did, sliding in or sitting and lifting knees demurely over, skirts decorously tucked. Into the silence, I took a sip and said, "Thank you, Mama. The tea is wonderful. Just what I need after a long night at a fire investigation." Mama's eyes were big as saucers. Daddy looked as if he'd been hit with a big stick right up across his noggin. Benjamin, however, looked intrigued, maybe even fascinated. His big baby blues latched onto me, and his full lips lifted into a slow smile, the corners curving up first, then his eyes crinkling. "It's a sure pleasure to meet you, Nell Nicholson." "Ingram," I said. "Special Agent Nell Ingram of Psylid Unit 18. "Ingram," he said back, as if committing it to memory. His eyes were a peculiar shade of blue that I figured would change with the light and with his emotions. His lashes were long and darker than his hair, and I had a feeling that he smiled often. A contented man. Benjamin said, "I'd heard that Sam's widder woman sister was with law enforcement, accomplished, competent. I didn't know she was such beauty, too." And darn if I didn't blush like a tomato and hide behind my tea mug like I was 12 years old. Benjamin flashed a set of straight teeth at me in a broader smile and swiveled his body to the head of the table. "Sam tells me Ewan's got a new tiller, Brother Nicholson. What brand?" The talk and all the attention fell away from me. I listened with half an ear and sipped my tea. 15 minutes after Benjamin and Sam arrived, I stifled a yawn, mumbled my goodbyes, and got up, gathering my jacket and coat and hurrying from the Nicholson house. Outside in the bright dawn, I yanked on my winter coat and opened the car door. Mud was curled up on the seat, wrapped in a blanket that she must have brought from inside. Her hair was reddish like mine, still long and unbunned. Saying that she was too young to be considered for marriage or concubinage, and for the menfolk to give the child a wide berth. She turned bright eyes to me. "You gonna marry Benjamin and move back home?" I climbed in, pushing her small frame across the seat and shutting the door. I turned on the truck and eased away from the front of the house so I could make a fast getaway if needed. I turned the heater